We have before us the opportunity to forge, for ourselves and for future generations, a new world order.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route.
Lee Oswald has been shot.
Paddock fired out of two adjoining rooms using a device similar to a hammer to smash the windows.
Several flying saucers there of extraterrestrial origin.
All right, well, that's do-it-yourself media, folks. Yeah, I don't know what that was all about, but that was my little intro for Digging Chris Graves. Welcome back, everybody. I appreciate all of you. I love all of you. And happy Thanksgiving for everyone in the States. And happy Thanksgiving to the Canadian Thanksgiving a month ago. Anyway, I am very honored that my guest today took the time to talk to me. He's a Canadian filmmaker, actor, editor, writer, and host of Conspiracy Synergy, Mr. T. Snyder. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I really appreciate it. Well, for those in the audience that are not familiar, could you just tell everyone a little bit about yourself and what basically how you got to where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I'm an artist. I started writing my first book when I was about 10 years old. Prior to that, I was writing really terrible screenplays that a kid would write. And I've kind of been working at it my entire life. I knew I was going to be a writer even before I knew how to read or write. And I would like slather my hand along a keyboard and print it so that my parents could point out what words I'd spelled at random. So it's always been something that I've had a calling for. And I'm quite driven towards, and that's evolved over the course of my life. It's something where I've been researching the conspiratorial threads of how things actually work for almost two decades now. So that invariably came to greatly influence the subject matter of my artwork. And my art has always centered around controversy. And that's because it's my belief, and I think that this is actually the most significant, or one of the most significant purposes of art in our life, is that it allows us to look at things that might be too difficult or painful to look at or talk about or come to terms with. But if you frame them in a different lens, in a story or in a narrative or a metaphor, something like that, then it kind of like acclimates people's perceptual ability so that they're able to bring it in and come to terms with it, talk about it openly, and then they're able to transmute that. And then that makes the world better for everybody. So increasingly, my drive to be a writer and an artist took me from my relatively like humble attempts to write things as a kid to eventually going to film school to making movies. And now I'm creating my own show, which is called Conspiracy Synergy. And that's an emotionally calibrated tool, an outreach tool for our friends and families, because a lot of them don't really have the courage or the knowledge or even the time to get into this kind of paradigm without feeling just overwhelmed and exhausted. So I'm like, okay, that as a conspiracy researcher and someone who's been deeply invested in this community for a long time, I found that that's the thing that people struggle with most. It's emotionally overwhelming. So I wanted to create a show that would appeal to the people who are experts, because they know all of the tiny little flashes of things that I put on screen, and also something that would be welcoming and inviting for people who are just getting introduced to the whole thing. So that's what I do.
That's great. When was your first film?
I went to film school. I think it was almost like 10 years ago now. And that was the first formal productions that I made in going to that. So it was like my halfway project was a music video. I went to film school in New York deliberately in order to create a thesis film called Blindfold, which is about a 9/11 widower and his preteen daughter coming to terms with the 9/11 truth. And that was in order to try and broach the realm of that subject in a emotional way rather than just focusing on the information. That was about 10 years ago. I released my first feature film called Hold Me, which is about a woman whose job it is to hold and console people who are being voluntarily euthanized, about 2016, so a while ago now. And since then, the last 4 years, I've been doing the show that I'm working on now. And I'm going to run to turn off my dryer because it's beeping right now in the background. So give me 1 second and I'll be right back.
Sure. Sure, sure. Anyway, for everyone here, now this I was very excited to talk to Tease for a while. And then, of course, anyone that's been following my stuff, I got pretty sick. So I'm glad we're able to do this now. So,
yeah, sorry about that. Okay. It's not
beeping. It's all good.
Anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you that you bring up 9/11 because that was kind of the event even more than things like the JFK assassination, which we just had the anniversary yesterday. I think we're probably around the same age, right? Like I was hatched back in the early 80s. So I think 9/11 was kind of like our JFK. And I just seeing all the anomalies and the weird stuff reporting, you know, the secondary explosions, you know, the weirdness with the Pentagon, you know, Pennsylvania, like the whole thing altogether. And then the following wars, you know, no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever, ties to Al-Qaeda and the anthrax attacks, that was pretty convenient. And then I started looking into like the DC sniper stuff that I'm convinced that there's some kind of connection with 9/11 witnesses with that. And I'm still working on that thesis, but with 9/11, did you think that just by, you said decades that you were looking into this stuff, do you think right off the bat, did it seem odd to you that whole day, or did it take you a couple of years like some other people that I've talked to?
So it was kind of both for me. I remember I was watching it happening on TV, and when the building literally like imploded, my jaw dropped with it because I'm like, that does not make sense. That should not have happened. Whatever the hell that is, it's like, that doesn't make sense to me. But it was prior to any point of exposure to just how horrifically corrupt everything actually is behind the scenes. So I didn't really piece it together. But then in an intuitive and artistic way, I kind of did in my own sense, because I was writing this script at the time, like once again, I was pretty young, but it was called To Zombie or Not to Zombie. And everyone was either on drugs or they were a zombie. So it was kind of a joke. You couldn't tell if someone was just a zombie or if they were really stoned. And in that script, the 7-Eleven had been bombed by the Bush administration. Right. And it was a metaphor for 9/11. And that was to take away all the munchies from the people who weren't zombies and they were just really stoned. And so in my own intuitive way, I'd pieced together that there's like, hey, you know, like there's the potential for a false flag. But it wasn't until I'd actually gotten into the whole zeitgeist thing that I was introduced to the notion that, hey, there's actually more to this. And then that's kind of just like one of those moments where you're like, holy shit, okay, well, where does that actually go? And yeah. Now here we are, like a long time later, still talking about the same things.
Yeah, no, a lot, unfortunately, a lot of the public doesn't even remember 9/11 or weren't even born yet. And I feel like in that regard, it really is kind of a parallel to the JFK assassination, because unfortunately, I don't think we're ever going to get any kind of real solution or kind of closure to both of those events, just because they've been so, whoever they are, they've been very successful in either breaking up truth movements or just burying evidence and silencing a lot of witnesses, especially in 9/11 and JFK. Now we got the whole COVID narrative, which also has a lot of parallels with 9/11, I feel like. I checked out your latest Conspiracy Synergy episode, and I wanted to ask you more about the global revolution, as you called it in the video and everything. How long did that take to put together? Because I had heard about it to be honest with you, from other folks that we both know. And I actually thought it was you were putting together kind of like a documentary. And in a way, it is like a mini documentary, the two parts. Was it part of did it start as something larger, or was that always the intent for the part one and part two of episode 8?
Well, so Conspiracy Synergy is me creating kind of like a cartoonish, simplified, but not inaccurate lore, so that people who have grown acclimated to film language, like you can think of like a Marvel movie or comic books or anything like that, they have their own kind of symbolism, which typically overlaps with reality, and then it briefly encapsulates it so that it's more accessible to everybody. So the entire project of Conspiracy Synergy is only, it's a finite thing. It's going to be a set 12 episodes with a bonus episode that I won't talk about until later. Some of those are going to have more than one part. But the entire thing is designed to be a quick encapsulative overview of the problems that we face as a species, the solutions that we very much can and need to implement, and the problems and the theoretical kind of like expanse of what we've yet to venture into. Because the more in which you dig into this stuff, the more you realize that it's like, holy crap, this is the next 50 to 60 years of our lives trying to piece together the puzzle that we were born into. And so it's bigger in the sense that it's all of that, but insofar as like the second part of the 8th episode, the musical montage at the end of it is a brief encapsulation of another post that I put up, which is everyone's unedited footage, which is like 2 hours of alternative media such as yourself talking about their thoughts and feelings and opinions on how we can all work together to save the world. So it's both of those things just came out, and there are different avenues for people to begin to explore the vast expanse of all that we've been digging into for a long time now.
No, it was great. It was excellent. And what would you say? Have you been disappointed with the alt media in the last few years? Do you feel like some of it has basically been infiltrated, not unlike, you know, COINTELPRO or Mockingbird that we've, you know, researched for years and years. You think this is just the next logical extension that, of course, they're going to have people planted that are going to poison the well?
Yeah. Okay. So great
question. It's a dumb question.
No, it's a really great question, actually, and it's an important one. And for those of us who have been in this for a long time,
really great people.
Oh, there was like an overlap there where you completely like jittered out. So 1 second, finish your question, and then I'll jump in.
Oh no, it was just I feel like there's a lot of decent, good, and decent people like Charlie Robinson, the AM Wake Up guys, you know, Steve and Chris. And there's a lot of good examples of alternative media right now. But then again, I can't help but get Mockingbird and that COINTELPRO type stuff out of my head when it comes to influencers and people, you know, maybe poisoning the well when it comes to actual decent reporting.
Okay, so I think it's a great question.
That was a very important one.
Yeah. And it's also, from your intuitive perspective, I think you're spot on. And I had watched the episode of yours that you'd sent me when you were hanging out with two other gentlemen talking about, is the alternative media dead? And that's an important question to ask. And that's coming from the perspective of analyzing an Alex Jones episode where it wasn't him, but it was kind of the lingering vestiges of him behind the scenes, speaking through the earpiece of the individual on the screen, shit talking the alternative media and the competency that we have as human beings, because we're not privy to the multi-million dollar studios, which frankly don't mean a fucking thing, because you can be in a multi-million dollar studio and know absolutely jack shit, nothing, have a tight top on, and more people will tune in just to watch that than they will actually care about the truth. So that's kind of like the environment that's been set for everyone. Insofar as the degree to which people are compromised, either in the sense of them being installed directly by these kinds of programs, or they're compromised for their own egotism and reluctance to venture into like the sophistication and complexity of how the truth works, because the truth is nuanced. It's one of those things where a lot of the time people will, through their own kind of volition, not necessarily instruction, come to a point of rigidity where they lack the malleability to connect dots outside of that box. And so many people are, in essence, doing the work for those kinds of organizations for them, unbeknownst to themselves. And it gets into one of those things where only those of us who have been doing it really hardcore for a really long time, who have the courage to question our own beliefs and convictions, to completely remove ourselves from that kind of superstitious thinking, can then convene and converge in a variety of different multifaceted ways to look at things and be all like, okay, what were we told? What is the reality? What can we actually corroborate in our, like, looking at these various different things? And then what can we extrapolate that given what we still don't know? And that's difficult because the more in which you go down that road, it becomes in a much, much smaller group of people who are actually doing that on the level that we need to do it on as a community. And at the exact same time as that, you get the bandwagon bullshit of motherfucking personalities out there who are presuming to speak for the alternative media, but really all they're doing is keeping them inside of those boxes. So it's one of those things where it's like a boxing match between all of us when really it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be us cooperating with one another as people to get to the bottom of the truth. And so that's kind of the environment that contests with our ability to do what we do.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Yeah. And the ego thing, that's even if it's not on a level where it's disinformation or, you know, purposefully trying to poison the well, I think just the human ego, you know, in any kind of media, that takes over a lot. I've seen that quite a bit, and I have not really been in this for that long. I mean, as a researcher, yes, but as a broadcaster or whatever I can call myself right now, I've seen a lot of examples of that, and that's not hard. That's actually, you know, because some people will be like, no, it's all disinfo that people, you know, sometimes people just, they get a pretty big head, you know, and that's what their downfall. So it's not always, because like when you really go in, you delve into conspiracy theory, or actually conspiracy analysis, I prefer. I'm not even sure where I was going with that, but I can see where ego actually could be another option, and not always the nefarious thing, but 9 times out of 10, it's.
You froze, so you'll come back in a second. Hopefully. Still frozen. All right. I will.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, now you're, it's, there's lag between us in the conversation. So you like, you just froze, and now you're back. So sorry. You were talking about how 9 times out of 10 it's ego, and it's not necessarily getting subverted by this large like conglomerate entity that we deem right. They. Yeah.
Right. Right. there was an awesome thing that you brought that is the basis of episode 8 about the global revolution, the love revolution, like the non-violent one. Can you tell everyone a little bit about that? Not a little bit, but just tell everyone about that. And it's a great idea, and the way that you present it, the way you edit it together, you're hilarious, you're on point. Please tell us.
Sure. So to start down that road, if people want to watch my show, it's good to start from the beginning. A lot of the people in this community will already know all that stuff, but it's a building of symbolism, informational nuance that becomes relevant later. And also you may just bump into stuff that you haven't heard yet and you'll be like, oh crap, wow, I thought I knew that, but I didn't know all of that. So in the second episode called Fashion Sedition, I get into how our idea of how we think of revolution has been deliberately poisoned by the establishment so that we think of it as fighting. But that's not really what revolution is. Revolution is re-evolution. It's supposed to be aligning ourselves with the force of love and then using that as the sort of like catapult or momentum to move forward in a better direction. And instead, it's all infighting and war and the idea of like violent revolution and all that kind of bullshit. That's poison. It completely destroys what we're trying to accomplish. This isn't about blowing things up. This is about building things. This isn't about fighting with one another. It's about cooperating with each other. This isn't about all of the lies and disinformation and political encampments and egotism. It's about getting away from all of that and bettering who we are as people by coming into alignment with the truth and the force of love. And that's twofold. First, our first principles. We need to know and understand what those are. And then two, we need to have the courage to stand by them. And that's what brings about peace on this earth. So that's the entire idea behind it, is that we need to understand what it genuinely means to be revolutionaries. It's being the best we can be as human beings, not just for ourselves, but for one another. And I can go into all kinds of different points of citation and reference for what that ultimately entails, but it falls outside of very much the societal establishment mindset that we have been predictively programmed by since birth.
What do you think some of the best examples of predictive programming to you would be?
Yeah. So literally, that's what Hollywood and the music industry and all of these kinds of things are. You can get into the celebration of holidays, which are themselves derived from very different kind of like pagan practices. You can look at the, it's basically everything at this point where we're at, and to different kind of minutia and degrees. You can think of the augmenting or let's say magnification of femininity through makeup. You know, just look at the wordplay. It's like, what are you making up for? You know, it's like, are you made up? Is that an idea of being made up? You can look at all these different kind of like subtle threads by which we go about accenting or augmenting our way of being. And then all of a sudden, it isn't the natural way in which we're people. Instead, it's sort of the molds and the habits that we've grown accustomed to that we then have a nostalgic and kind of just like affinity for so much that it's inseparable from how we identify ourselves. And that's that cradle to grave marketing technique, which just surrounds us and envelops us so much that the idea of being separate from it is just, it seems crazy until you really look at it and you think, well, is that beneficial? Is it helping humanity? And a lot of the time it's not. It's just poison painted as if it's beautiful.
Yeah. I learned a lot about that through the work of the late Dave McGowan. I'm not sure if you're a fan of his or not. I saw that you had Programmed to Kill, like in some of the imagery. He was pretty spot on, especially with the weird scenes inside the canyon, things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So Dave McGowan did really, really great work, as is the case with, which I find with all of us as researchers, we can only do so much. So there are points of his stuff where I found that he was just not accurate, particularly page 120 of Programmed to Kill. He goes into Satan's family tree and he draws a lot of connections from like theosophy and other things that aren't actually backed up. That's a conflating of things. There's a book I have called The Occult Roots of Nazism that would actually get into what that kind of thing is. But he was basically sort of like copy and pasting the common story that we have and then using that as a catalyst for kind of just like lumping things together, which happens. It happens with all of us. He's a brilliant man. He did great work. It's a really good book on the whole. And Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, I've also used as a reference for the second episode in Fashion Sedition, which is my show. And I stand by him. I think he's a really great guy who did really great work and may, in fact, given how his cancer progressed, potentially have become inconvenient. So it's one of those things where we don't ultimately know. And the more in which we all do this as researchers, we kind of like stumble back on our own stuff and be like, okay, is that the truth? Is it not the case? But yeah, Dave McGowan, I think he's really fucking great. He's solid.
Yeah. I've been in contact with his brother, Craig, for a little while now. And when Craig's ready, we've talked about him coming on and talking about the last year of Dave's life, because there was a lot of weird shit going on and a lot of weird people and women like coming around and things. And I think there's a lot more to that story. Yeah. And if you look at things like Jack Ruby, you know, as a good example of someone, you know, he was being jabbed in his jail cell with something. And if you look even further back, like the possibility that him and Oswald and Ferry and all those people were involved with advanced cancer weapons and research and things like that. Some people don't buy into that. Some people do. But the idea, you know, of cancer weapons is not the stuff of, you know, let's say, reptilians or something. Not to say that that's not a thing either, but you know, when they put these things into the realm of science fiction, like weather weapons, MK Ultra, like, oh yeah, they couldn't do that. It's science fiction, and it's introduced through Hollywood as being science fiction. I think that's a way they get away with a lot of this stuff, when a lot of this stuff very well could happen and most likely does happen for whatever political or whatever, you know, monetary, you know, means or whatever. And that's my soapbox. But anyway, but yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Dave McGowan's, but he wasn't always spot on, but his stuff with the Boston bombing and 9/11, I feel like he was really one of the first 9/11 truthers on 9/12, because he pretty much broke down the whole story on his website, like on 9/12. Yeah. But off on that tangent, good stuff. But I understand what you were saying too, because I've heard that before about, I forget the exact chapter, the page number 101 on
Program. It's page 120 in his book, Programmed to Kill, which is, on the whole, is a good book. But the chapter title is Satan's Family Tree, I believe. And basically conflating a lot of things that aren't actually the same as if they are. And that's like, you'd have to get into the forensic history of it, which is why I recommend the book, The Occult Roots of Nazism, because that is the forensic history of it. And that's when you get into the hardcore shit. Yeah. And it's the Thule Society and all of these sort of things being just like, oh man, when you get into what Nazism was and communism too, they're two like wings of the same schism, and they were designed to create long incubative periods of conflict over centuries. So it's really surreal when you get into how deep this stuff goes and how meticulously planned it is and how long it takes to reveal itself over time.
Yeah, absolutely. The long game, if you will.
Yeah. It's a great game, yeah.
Well, it's a great game. very depressing game. Yeah. I don't want to just keep asking you, like, what did you think of this guy or this woman or anything? but I was curious what your take on the late Bill Cooper was, because he could be divisive too with people.
It's one of those things. I'm not really adequately informed with Bill Cooper. I've only heard little snippets of his. He is sort of like the archetypal character that Alex Jones, you know, came to adopt or to co-opt, you know. And so that's one of those things where you can get into that perspective of it. But I'm not well-versed enough in the firsthand exposure to him and his information to be able to speak adequately on it. But that's just a little gist of my takeaway from who he was and what he brought forward.
And that's one of the reasons why I love you, sir, because there are other people that would give a fuck. They would give an opinion that was based on nothing. And you admitted that you're like, yeah, I don't really know enough to be able to intelligently be able to comment on that. And that's great, because I feel like there's a lot of it. I try to do that myself, you know. Actually, I always do that myself, because if anyone smells any bullshit, they'll call you out on anything else you say. And I don't want to be wrong anyway. And if, you know, admitting that you're wrong, a lot of people can't do either. And I'll be the first one to say, hey, I got this information wrong, and I'll try to report. Not try, I will report it anyway. So I'm going on another soapbox. But how did you come to kind of team up with the AM Wake Up guys? Like, or how, like, were you a fan of Steve and Chris, like, for a while, or?
Okay. Yeah, sure. So You sort of just get exposed to people in the community, because we all listen to each other's stuff, and then you'll get references and be like, hey, check this person out if you're not familiar with that. So that ends up happening. I had sent, I'd known Steve's work through, like, I'd seen him on the Union of the Unwanted and his Slow Newsday show and stuff prior to AM Wake Up starting. I had sent him the fourth episode of my show, Gamify Revolution, which goes into Cecil Rhodes and that whole kind of thing, and the Anglo-American establishment and its emergence in a really funny and stupid way, which is typically my manner when it comes to my show, because it's more accessible and enjoyable for people to approach it that way. And I sent him to that, and he reposted and he liked it a lot. And at some point, the conversation had come up with basically just, oh, hey, because they invite people on the show, I got invited one time. And that was back when Pasta was still co-hosting, but he wasn't there that day. So it was just me and Steve kind of hanging out. And that was good, and it went well. And I came back on a few weeks later, and that was good as well. And then another few weeks went by, or months, and came back on. And the audience was very receptive to me, and they liked me a lot. So they were asking if I could come by more often and everything. And that's something I'm an artist, so I'm both arrogant in the sense that I know what I'm good at, but I'm also humble and insecure in a way in which I know I can always get better. So it's kind of both of those things at the same time. I didn't really want to jump in as a co-host because I'm aware of the fact that a lot of my research in certain like contemporary realms or conspiratorial avenues is not necessarily adequate to be able to speak like in depth about a lot of this shit. I mean, yeah. I've like, fuck, it's one of those things where all of us, even those of us who've been doing it for decades, you're still always learning. It's just like that. It's, there's so much. So it was one of those things where I kind of shied away from it, but then I'm like, okay, well, what if we use it as a platform on Wednesdays to try and create a community of participation with the people who watch the show so that they could hopefully present my show, Conspiracy Synergy, to their friends and family and gradually build up a conversation platform that we could then share on the Wednesday segment while also talking to people who are doing firsthand work in order to create real world solutions. Now, we've been doing that on Wednesdays. I'm the co-host of AM Wake Up on Wednesdays, but the audience participation part has not been happening. And that's very disappointing because people shy away from the giving other people these kind of references and things because they've been beaten up for so long just trying to share it. And it's difficult for them to conceive of the tools having been created that make that easier for them, because that's what my show is. That's what Conspiracy Synergy is. It's, you can use this as the outreach tool. I'm not talking about the people who are just like impossible. I'm talking about the people who are like mid-tier, the mid-range. You can reach
the pill, them. The pill is halfway down the throat.
Yeah, kind of like that thing. And it's just like, hey, here's a little bit of water. Here's some time, something to allow you to be able to enter into that paradigm without feeling like just absolutely terrified or abandoned or betrayed. And that's actually ultimately, if you get to what the emotional problem that most people are facing is, that betrayal is brutal. It isn't just being attacked or wounded. It's being turned on by those who you trusted more than anything. And that's what most people just don't want to acknowledge, is how bad they've been betrayed. And so it's kind of an emotional catalyst for all of us to get together, to laugh about it in the morning, in the way in which Steve does brilliantly. And he brought Chris on as his co-host more often. And I think they both do incredible work. So it's one of those things where I just pop by Wednesdays and kind of co-host the show with them. But we're still always trying and hoping to get more audience participation and firsthand examples of people sharing this, so that we can then share that with the audience and be like, hey, see, it is possible to get people to come around. You just have to be a little bit kinder and give them the certain presentations that are an introduction to the entire expanse of the alternative media. So that's kind of how that came about.
No, it's fantastic. And I always look forward to Wednesdays. You bring a lot to that program. And I like your style and everything. I don't mean to keep buttering you up, but no, it's true. It's kind of like the what's the Mary Poppins thing? A spoonful of sugar.
Sugar makes... helps the medicine go down. Yeah,
right. So it's kind of like that. You got to have, because this shit gets dark, man. This is dark stuff, and I've had to walk away from it a bunch of different times. Is there a topic or a particular conspiracy or event that you won't go near?
No, I make a point of going directly into all of it, especially the stuff that I don't want to deal with, but that's just because I need to understand if it's real, because that's ultimately what this is about. This isn't about like, I like this, I don't like that. It's like, okay, what is actually truth? What's the reality of it? Not what am I comfortable with? What do I have a preference for? Right. What is actually real? And that's one of those things where it's not that you can't shy away from it, but it's that we're morally obligated to confront it, to be able to account for it. And only then are we able to fix it. And so that's one of those things where it is ultimately a moral responsibility. And I see that as ultimately the thing that we're supposed to be doing more as the alternative media. This is about truth, freedom, and morality, first and foremost. But so many people get caught by demographics that they either disproportionately pander to things, or they run away from, or simply refuse to address certain things. And that's kind of just like the environment that's come about.
Because I know certain people that they won't touch subjects like the Holocaust. They won't touch, you know, other incendiary or whatever the word is, certain things for fear that they're going to screw up their career, or they're going to be, you know, labeled this or that. Usually it's an anti-Semitism kind of thing, or a racist thing or whatever. And like, I'm not afraid really to go anywhere. Like, it's wherever the facts are, but some people won't even go near the possible facts. And that's why I brought that up. Like, I'm not even talking about the more outlandish stuff, because of course you got to vet everything, like you said, you know, see if it's even a real thing or the possibility of it. But
yeah, no, I hear you when it comes to the Holocaust, like getting into the whole sarin gas thing, the Auschwitz not necessarily having the infrastructure that they needed in order for it to, like, I've toured Auschwitz personally. So it's like, I've been there
really?
Through the tour. Yeah. And it's interesting. It was brutal. It was an awful place. The particular semantics that they get into when you get into like the 6 million Jews number, it wasn't actually that much. It was a conflating of people who were anti-fascism. And then there's a lot of other things thrown in on top. So, and like, you can look at the ethnic cleansing that happened post-World War of the German citizens themselves, wherein 250,000 died through their relocation at the hands of people who were exterminating them.
Yeah.
It was brutal and horrific. And like, you can get into the Dresden like bombing and like all the, there's so much that when you really get into it, you're just like, whoa, this was a cross-cultural Nazism. And then you can look at like Wall Street funding into being Nazism, and the IB Farben not being bombed so that it could continue, the all these different things. So it was a much more deliberate creation by the Anglo-American establishment. And we point fingers and say, oh, it was only Nazism. Oh yeah, that was evil. No shit, people. But there was a lot more evil going on than just that. Oh, you're frozen again. Oh, there, you're back.
I apologize. My signal sucks. So I apologize to everyone out there. I hope we're getting some good stuff coming through at least. But and the Holocaust isn't even something I personally really dove into in terms of, like, I've seen some of the questions that other people over the years have brought up, but I just haven't really taken the time because I've been busy with things like 9/11 and JFK Jr., Columbine, TWA 800, things like that, more recent stuff. But I can see why, you know, other people are like, oh, you know, because they create these lightning rod topics where it's like, even with Sandy Hook, like even bringing that up, or Pizzagate or whatever your thoughts are on those things. I don't like the idea that we're made to feel like we can't question things. That's what pisses me off.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Same page, man. I know what you mean.
So, since you're a filmmaker and that's something that I've been trying to do for a long time now, and I will do that next year. I will, before I pass on, in independent film. Do you have any advice? This probably sounds cliche and maybe a little stupid, but do you have any advice for up and coming filmmakers on how to get their material actually in existence? I know it's a loaded question. I apologize.
No, it's cool. So it's, the film industry is not there to make your film or distribute your film. It's there to keep your film from getting made and keep it from being distributed. The film industry is actually more of like a Teamster organization, so that they can keep that kind of like consolidated framework of celebrity worship, predictive programming, overlap with the intelligence apparatus, largely unbeknownst to the population. That's extended into streaming platforms and kind of things like that. You can do your individual distribution submissions for films and stuff, but like, to get my film Hold Me on iTunes cost $3,000 for the submission process. It's a $75 annual upkeep in order to keep it listed, and they retain half of every sale. So it's really basically just the large distribution platforms are there to fuck individual like content creators and filmmakers. And generally speaking, people don't understand how hard it is, how expensive it is, how much it takes. My film took 5 years to make. It put me $100,000 personally in debt because I paid out of pocket to make it. And I've barely anybody knows it exists because everyone basically just gravitates towards whatever they hear their friends talking about rather than whatever it is that independent creators make. And that's a broken and backwards and parasitic system that we all continue to play into because we like movies. We like watching quality films that speak to important themes. And it's really, really difficult to do that on the level that we have grown accustomed to. So the entire industry needs to change. And the way in which that will eventually come into being is through decentralized filmmaking. And decentralized filmmaking is when people and their friends and family and their connections on a neighborhood level start making their own films, be they documentaries or narratives, and they start doing it in a community basis. And then you share those cross community and with one another so that it's an ability to teach media literacy and then also share communal stories. And then that can then proliferate and become something that expands on a global level. But what it is right now is designed to inhibit and encumber our consciousness and our ability to connect with one another. That needs to change and disappear and be completely turned around so that it can be the right way up.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, no, yeah, Hollywood is quite the cesspool.
It's fucking evil. That's like one of the epicenters. It's like the more in which you get into it, it has to work that way. Because if you look at like Sun Tzu's, it's like all war is based on deception. It's like that really is the epicenter of war is the archetypal framing that we then adore and go out there and ourselves basically just play the part of. Most people are actors, enamored by actors so much that they aren't actually able to get to the depth of who they are or to escape the bars and find a way to get other people out of those cages themselves. So it's really surreal. It's installed that kind of like limited mentality within everybody, and then they worship it. It's fucking crazy.
Do you have any personal favorite independent, like the type of films that you were referring to, you know, making in community, in different communities that are connected and possible? Do you have any favorites when it comes to that? Like in the indie cinema that are not utilizing the bigger platforms and Hollywood at all. Like do you have any that people could check out?
I'd like to, but I don't even watch movies anymore. It's because it's like, I don't watch fiction basically at all. I will very rarely occasionally do that with stuff that Hollywood puts out, not because I like them, but because it's like, I have to like break it down in a predictive programming, like to understand what kind of shit they're putting out. And then because what I do is I take snippets from well-known nostalgia and the films that we all grew up with, because it communicates a great deal. And then I'll include that in my show so that I can have your full reference of awareness of a story very quickly realized so that I have to go into more detail. I've already accounted for it visually. So sometimes I'll come across films that are in existence that have a great deal of nostalgia tied to them that I need to understand better, so I'll watch that kind of stuff. But I don't watch TV shows, I don't watch anything anymore. So I should have answers to that question, but unfortunately I don't, just because I've completely removed myself from it. There was an example of people remade RoboCop, where it was everyone submitting their own tiny little snippets of it, and there's like a portion where it's puppets and paper mache. So that's an example of a funny way of doing that. Like my personal, one of my favorite films going way back is Dinner with Andre. And that's based on a play. And Dinner with Andre, it's just two people sitting there having a conversation, but it's a brilliant film because it really allows you to venture into that. And so it's one of those things where there need to be, you're correct, like kind of examples that we can show that, hey, we are doing it on the level of them. In fact, we're doing it better than them. Support that kind of thing and we'll do it more. You can look at a film like Jones Plantation, which came out recently, and I did watch that. I think that that's a good example of a good film, but it's not great. Because if you juxtapose that with something like 12 Years a Slave, my personal opinion, Steve McQueen is like one of the best directors out there. Guy's fucking incredible. He also did Hunger and Shame. The Hunger goes into like the persecution of the Irish Liberation Army who were starving themselves. And it's played by Fassbender. I can't remember his name.
Michael Fassbender.
So, and that's a brilliant film. But like that 12 Years a Slave is like orders of magnitude more brilliant than Jones Plantation. But Jones Plantation, insofar as the information that it's presenting for the purpose of applying that understanding in reality, is itself more important. So it's one of those things where the artistic accents have to be up to an equivalent of what we've come to expect from Hollywood. And that's so difficult and expensive to do that people cannot fathom it. So it's one of those ongoing evolutions that we need to saddle up for, because it's the upper echelon of the human experience of what we're able to accomplish and transcendence. That's art. That isn't just specific to artists, because everything could be an art form. If you're a cabinet maker and you do that on the next level, that becomes art. So art is the future of us being able to make everything better.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's so true. And that was one of the things I wanted to touch upon with you, the importance of art and in this world that's pretty dark. And it seems like that there's a concerted effort to kind of just erase art or statues or whatever, you know, in the last few years. And it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same, especially if there is no real history. And that's that, you can go into that too. You know, a friend of mine wrote a book called Hidden History. So it's like, you don't really know whatever's being taught, if it's the real deal, unless you actually go and look for yourself, you know, and that. And of course, like you had said in quite a few videos, or some people, or even earlier just now, some people just don't have the time because they're overworked, they're overwhelmed. They have all these things like being thrown at them on the nightly news or whatever, you know, COVID, we got race riots, we got PSYOPs up the ass, we got this and that and everything. And, you know, dead people as presidents, possibly, you know, all this other weird shit going on. UFOs apparently are acceptable now, you know, all these like distractions. What is your take? I know you've talked about it just obviously on AM Wake Up and on your own stuff, but, currently, what do you think that was just like, because some people thought that was the beginning of Project Bluebeam or whatever from years ago that Bill Cooper used to talk about. Do you think that was basically a smokescreen for some of this other stuff that was going on, like, you know, things behind the scenes with China? You got the Ukraine distraction. Now, obviously, we got the Mossad or the Hamas, whatever you want to call it, whatever that whole thing is right now, which is also a lightning rod to talk about, apparently. But I'll talk about it, whatever. Do you think that UFO thing is, are they going to have another stage to that whole, like, disclosure with, I guess, the latest guy, David Grush, or something. He was just on Joe Rogan, which is kind of disheartening in a couple of ways, but I know there was a question in there somewhere. So you're like, where the hell did he, where did he begin?
I got you. Remember. Yeah. So the sixth episode of my show is called The Future of Warfare. And I go into the alien PSYOP, and I'm not actually talking about real aliens in that, which if you get into would strongly suggest interdimensional entity attachments and the influence that things that depending on different contextual lenses we would describe in other ways. So from a biblical contextual lens, it would be angels and demons. From like a materialist lens, it would be interdimensional kind of like forces in nature that have a certain influence and effect on us. There are all kinds of different avenues you can go about exploring these kind of things. And at the beginning of the episode, I give people references if they want to dive into that. You can look at Dark Journalist is a good one. He'll go into a lot of this kind of stuff. He's been studying ufology and the overlap with the history of mysticism and mystery schools and the occult and all that kind of stuff, because none of this stuff is separate. And right. So when you get into the deliberate predictive programming seeding of the public's perception of these sort of things, it is rooted in science fiction, as you were alluding to earlier. And that's so that we will be disproportionately materialist in the way in which we approach these kinds of subjects. And that's detracts from the occult science side of things. Religion itself is another example of that, which inhibits the degree to which we understand reality, and instead we fall within tradition and superstitious kind of models as a supplementary kind of realm that we permit ourselves, because a lot of the conclusions are actually correct. Like, the conclusions are correct, but at the same time, it isn't all there. And so that becomes deeply problematic, because it's a prolonged manner of keeping the general public unaware. And so what we're entering into with all of this, like, alien stuff is a materialist framing of the human origin story in order to create a predictive programming model that they've been building up for 70 plus years within a framework that can then commandeer everyone's hearts and minds moving into the future more and more. And I would argue that we ourselves in the alternative media are the apparatus by which they want that to go mainstream. And so you can look at things like a lot of the people who are trusting Bob Lazar or Lou Alessandro are themselves just playing into the model that has been built for us to fill. And you can look at, like, Gaia TV being another example of that. So there are all these kind of, like, co-opted entities that then control the public dialectic of a lot of different intersecting and converging things that have been slow cooked to manifest proportionately to the degree to which we are willing to tolerate and embrace them. Because a lot of how PSYOPs work is that it isn't anything until you're willing to accept it. If they go out there and they hit you with something that you don't even perceive, it doesn't matter if they hit you with it. You need to be acclimated to be receptive to it. So this is the calculative refinement of acclimating the public to be receptive to whatever the hell they create based on our receptivity. It's a feedback cycle.
Yeah. I always have my thoughts on Gaia TV, but I just couldn't quite put my finger on it. Like, I was always questioning, you know, I had a feeling about it. I know that sounds goofy, but I just had, like, a sense.
Dude, intuition's really important. Like, the more in which you refine that, that's a hell of a thing. You, like, instinct is animal base level upper echelon, but intuition is when you enter, like, the spiritual side of things. That's, like, a whole other realm. So that's a really important thing.
So that's good. That's good. How does one fine tune that? Or is that one of those things where you kind of have to just learn as you go, like, to fine tune it?
Yeah. Intuit.
I can't even pronounce it now.
Intuition. Yeah. No, it is. It's heart-based intelligence. So that's your heart conjoined with your calibrated hemispheres, your left and right hemisphere thinking, as well as your gut. And so it's those three things which, when balanced with one another, and you need to sort of, like, learn to listen to yourself, the foods you eat, if you do any drugs, if you're physically active, all of these different things affect how receptive you are, whether you muddle the fine-tuned vibrations of your own heart. You can look at something called, like, heart math as the actual physics of understanding that. But it becomes one of those things where holistic health is one of, like, the main ways in which we're being sabotaged as a species, because you can get into the degree to which we're able to actually do really profound and incredible things, but because of the environments we exist in, because of our mental state of things, it inhibits our expanse. And so it is one of those things where it's the subtle course correction, and it isn't just necessarily the things that you would think, because they're all interlinked. You know, so it is your diet. It is your exercise level. It is the people you know. It is how you think of yourself. It's that and so much more. You can think of something as your own teeth. Those correspond with your vertebrae. So if you have back problems, it can be because of other things. You know, it's like, it's so expansive. It's like, go out there and ground yourself. Actually connect with the earth. It's like all these different things. Try meditating. If that doesn't isn't your thing, there are other avenues. It's also highly specific to you. Some people are profoundly electrosensitive. Other people, they can basically get a taser to the nuts and it won't necessarily knock them out. If anything, it'll get them up. So it's one of those
things. Call that a Friday night. That's a Friday night right there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it's one of those things where, yes, it's all of that, but it's also very, very much you. And so the more in which you allow yourself to be empowered by that notion, the more in which you're able to remove yourself from kind of like everything around you and realize that if you really up your game, you're able to overcome just about anything that's been put before you.
Oh, that was beautiful, dude. Like, I'm going to be going back and watching this over and over again, just to like, just process it, savoring all the flavor of what you just said right there. Just in closing, have you had a dream project or a dream film, not dream, but like a film eventually you want to get to, like in terms of a narrative film or even a documentary or anything that you want to be able to bring into existence before you expire on this mortal coil, as they say, or whoever, or Shakespeare or something. I'm an idiot, but
no, I hear you. Yeah, I mean, my projects are always slow cooked. I'm like, I'm good at what I do, but I'm fucking slow. And that's because this stuff takes a really long time.
You want to be meticulous too. So there's nothing wrong with that.
No, totally. And so there are all kinds of different things that I've been slowly working on. A lot of my book projects, the one that I've been working on the longest is actually, I've been writing it for 15 years now. And it's a 4-part book. I have the first two out. The first one is called Rise. The second one's Risen. The third one that I'm slowly writing, but I won't ultimately actually write until I've done all of this research associated with my show, Conspiracy Synergy. It's going to be called Fall. And then the next one, it'll probably take me another 10 or 20 years. But that's because the story of it is really simple. It's a bunch of people or kids who grew up preparing for the zombie apocalypse. And then 20 years later, it happened. And because they grew up preparing for it, they're uniquely situated to actually be responsible in the face of it. And it's a metaphor for the truth movement. It's a metaphor for how all of us have been studying conspiracy and how the world really works and preppers and all that kind of stuff, who then it's like, whoa, we're actually in a unique position to be the saviors, or not the saviors necessarily so much as those survivors who help inspire other people. Yeah, the inspirers. That's kind of what we do. We can do that if we do it right. And so that's a really cool project. And I have the first audiobook for the first one up on YouTube. People can listen to it for free. Way that I've worked my website is that I put all of the PDFs of all of my stuff up so that you can just read it if you like. You can buy it from like the Amazon if you want, but I make like nothing off of that. You can get it from Lulu. That's a way to directly order it. But you can also just try it out and then just give me a donation if you appreciate having that out there for everyone, because I think art is something that we're supposed to give away to each other, and that's ultimately what makes it so that we're able to share in that and celebrate it and pass it along, rather than have it be this like coveted thing under an industry umbrella. So the seeds for that are already out there. The first book is called Rise. The second one is Risen. You can already check them out on my website, teace.ca. It's teace.ca. And that would be something which potentially moving forward a decade or more could make a really incredible project that not just myself, but a lot of people could participate in a decentralized model of filmmaking, where incrementally more and more we remove Hollywood and we replace it with us and what we want to create and what we want to make, because that's the future.
Yeah, no, that's great. I've had something in the works since 2003. So when it comes to being far behind, I'm pretty far behind, because it was something called Wasted Youth, and it was gonna be like, in my head, I'm like, that's gonna be my Clerks, you know, because Kevin Smith and his whole thing. I'm like, that's gonna be my Clerks, and like now, and it was supposed to be about a guy loosely based on this guy that had a quarter life crisis, which I didn't even know was a thing at the time, but apparently people can have quarter life crisis, which sounds really fucking stupid because you're only in your 20s, you know, nothing's happened yet. So I might try to step into that pile again, you know, coming up, but I got other things in the works right now. But anyway, I really appreciate you talking to me today, and I hope you'll come back. Will you come back? I want to get that on camera. Will you come back?
Yeah, okay. We can hang out. It's cool.
We can hang out a little bit. Yeah, I can hang out with you. Yeah. Can you tell everyone where best to support your work, where they can make a donation, like you had just said, and where they can find you if you want to be found?
Yeah, for sure. So my website as an artist is teace.ca. It's TEACE.ca because I'm in Canada. There you can find all of the sort of things that I've done. And my website for the show, which is conspiracy related, is conspiracysynergy.com. And that's where you can go to watch the show that I'm making now. As far as donating or contributing, I really like it when people buy t-shirts because then you get something in return. I don't make a huge amount on it, but it's something where I value that it's conversation starters, and it's a good opportunity that way. You can make like PayPal or crypto or buy me a coffee donations and stuff like that. And it really means a lot because those of us in the alternative media who do this kind of stuff, we get very, 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 very little support. Like, it would shock people if they understood how much more work we put in than we get anything back. And that's kind of just the reality of how much sacrifice goes into this fight, because we're up against people who are sponsored like billionaires and we scrape together a few dollars. So if you even have a dollar or two and you think that that doesn't matter to the people in the alternative media, it actually really does. So not just for myself, for everyone, including Chris and all the people that you watch often, please make a point of supporting them, because they need that in, yes, a financial way, but also in an emotional way where it's just like, hey, keep doing that work because it counts. And so that's the two main places you can find me is teace.ca and conspiracysynergy.com. And I co-host Wednesdays on AM Wake Up, so you're always welcome to swing by and chill out there and see what Steve and Chris are up to, because they're brilliant and they do great work too.
I love those guys. And I love Shelly too. Shelly's great too. Yeah,
Shelly's cool people.
I'm going to say goodbye to you off air, if that's cool. And then I'm going to end the stream right now. And everyone, sure. I just want to appreciate everyone for, you know, that's, you know, listening later or watching later or even watching live. I didn't get to check the chat. So I wanted to focus everything on Teace right now, because I get spacey these days for different reasons. But anyway, thank you, everyone. And I love you all. And till we talk again. All right. Bye.